You are tuned to CICK News on 93.9 FM in Smithers. CICK News is your news source for regional and provincial news Tuesdays and Thursdays at 8 a.m., 2 p.m., and 4 p.m. It's hosted by Dan Messick and myself, Pamela Hassan. Find and follow CICK News online at smithersradio.com and frequencynews.ca or wherever you get your podcasts. CICK News is funded by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Government of Canada.
Today on CICK News, Jennifer Rice is the current NDP MLA for the riding of North Coast, but after 11 years in the legislature, she's stepping back from politics to focus on her young family. Rice has held a few different portfolios over the years, most recently as the Parliamentary Secretary for Rural Health. Although the decision to step back was bittersweet, Rice says she outlined some of her accomplishments since she was originally elected in 2013, most recently the passing of the Rising Tide Haida Title Lands Agreement. I had an exclusive sit-down with MLA Jen Rice to talk about her time in Victoria, decorum in the ledge, and what comes next for her. Stay with us.
Jennifer Rice, and I'm the MLA for North Coast, and we are hanging out at Yaga's Coffee Shop and Garden Center in Prince Rupert.
Yes, it's one of the spots in town.
It's definitely a spot. I love it here. It's a great place. You grab a coffee, walk around, look at trees, plants, flowers, and connect with all kinds of people, walk the dog along the Seal Cove Trail. It's an amazing place. I love this part of town.
You announced that you're not going to be running again this coming October. And looking back, you know, I had to remind myself that you were once a councillor here in Prince Rupert. And a lot of things have changed in Rupert. You know, we're down here at Yaga. This wasn't here 10 years ago. The marsh is the same thing, a spot. I see lots of people. I bring my kid down here. Lots of people walking around the marsh. What kind of, maybe give me a little bit of background, kind of what sticks out in your mind here in Rupert? You've been the MLA for a number of years now, three terms, and a lot has changed in Rupert. But right now, things seem to be happening. It seems to be a happen in town.
It's definitely a happen in town. A lot of things are kind of coming to fruition all at the same time, which is really interesting. But it's looking better, for example, just if we talk about it from an aesthetic point of view. Buildings are being cleaned up, burnt down buildings are being removed, land being cleared so that it's build ready. We've got housing projects that a few that have come to fruition, and we have quite a few more on the books. Yaga, bought out by the Niska Gitmakmakai Society, and they've totally renovated, transformed this place into a beautiful place that's more than just a plant nursery. It's a community gathering space. There's a lot of construction, which I think is really disruptive to people, and it's a bit ironic when I've heard quite a few complaints about the state of the town for quite a few years, and then we're finally fixing a lot of things and the people are upset about the construction. But, you know, once it's complete, I think people will be really happy and really satisfied.
You know, what are some of the things that stand out in your mind over the years that, you know, in your riding here that have shifted? You know, 10 years ago, the politics, you know, this type of, like what we were just talking about, the atmosphere, the aesthetics of this community were different, but it seems a lot more lively than it used to be. What are some of the things that stand out in your mind that in your time have kind of helped usher along?
Well, I mean, for starters, I'll go back over 20 some years ago. I came here to Prince Rupert to attend what is now called Coast Mountain College. Back then it was Northwest Community College. I had been traveling for a year all over interesting places. French Polynesia, Australia, New Zealand, around the States. And the furthest west I'd ever been from my hometown of Ottawa was Winnipeg. And so I had a career shift. I worked in long-term care for a very long time. I started when I was 14. And I was a passionate scuba diver. And so I went off, and just like we have ski bums, I was a bit of a scuba bum. And when I came back, I didn't really want to go back into that field. I worked for a for-profit nursing home, and I really learned the value of public health care. And I really struggled with my values. Anyways, a long-winded story to say I wanted to be on the coast, and I ended up in Prince Rupert. I came for 3 years. I've been here over 20-some, and then somehow I ended up representing the place as a city councillor and then as an MLA, and I've been the MLA for 11 years now. So a lot has changed since I first arrived. When I first arrived, there was still talk about the mill reopening, and that was really heavy on, or just prominent in discussions. And I don't hear those discussions anymore whatsoever. And the Port of Prince Rupert has rapidly expanded. They're just exponentially growing. And, they've had, I can't even keep up with the iterations of project development that they've built, but they're the fastest growing port in North America. They're doing over $60 billion a year in trade. So that's very different. And I think that's definitely changed the way Prince Rupert has looked. I think, historically, often for rural communities, we've always associated rural development or rural economic development by bringing in large capital projects and thinking, the labor will come. And I think it's really different right now. We need workers. It's not about the capital investment right now. It's like, we need the workers to actually fulfill the jobs that are currently here. And there are, more to come. And that's not really a speculative statement. That is in the works. Yeah. And so it's interesting to go from focusing on capital to now focusing on labor. Mm. But as far as you mentioned, we've come so far as Indigenous rights goes, as far as the discussion. Sadly, sometimes it takes crisis and tragedy to actually find the opportunity. And I think one thing that really stands out for me, and it's not just unique to the riding or BC, but it's Canada, people are much more informed on the history of Canada and, the truth of how Canada's First Peoples were treated. And I think a lot of people are doing, are trying to do the work to actually reconcile that.
We'll come back to that in a sec, but, just want to touch upon the issue of labor. And that's something that definitely, since the last few months that I've been hanging out here more, I've noticed. So clearly things are going on here that is attracting people, but there are some hang-ups. One that I hear about constantly now is with the hospital, the healthcare situation in Rupert. Where are things at right now, and kind of where have they gotten to, knowing that we need to attract these people? And those are some of the things that they look at: family doctors, the hospital, keeping Emerge open. So where are kind of things at now, and what have you seen over your time?
So, yes, I would say, linking back to your first comment around the labor, so some of the biggest barriers that we're facing as far as attracting and retaining the labor has a lot to do with a lack of housing and a lack of childcare, which we have invested a lot of money, we're talking billions of dollars here, into creating more spaces, making childcare more affordable, building houses, changing all sorts of legislation. So housing projects can be built faster, quicker, easier. And then the other thing you mentioned was just recently our ER in Prince Rupert, our emergency room, for the first time in the entire history of that hospital, which is probably older than I am. I'm pushing half a century.
Probably older.
Probably, okay, yeah. But that was a first, and that was really, really scary for people here in Prince Rupert. It doesn't make it okay, but it's not unique to Prince Rupert. In January of 2023, I was appointed BC's Parliamentary Secretary for Rural Health. That's a role I requested of David Eby, our Premier, because I live it, I see it, and I hear it. I've been here over 20-some years. Back in 2013, actually, when Adrian Dix was our leader, he appointed me the first critic for Northern and Rural Health. And so we know that rural communities need a little extra TLC when it comes to recruiting and retaining the workers we need to deliver the same quality of healthcare that people in urban centers get. Hasn't been easy. COVID really set things back, and not just here locally, not here in BC, Canada, but around the world. And right now we are in a global health worker shortage. And that's everything from nurses, doctors, lab techs, all the allied health, psychology, like everybody, as far as health delivery goes. And so we're in this really competitive market, and literally we are poaching healthcare workers from other jurisdictions, and then other jurisdictions are poaching them from us. So it's, if you're a healthcare worker, you're in dire need everywhere. And so you're in a good place to negotiate what, where, and when, and how you want to work. But yes, only recently did we experience those ER closures. And but the, that, you know, not to be bleak, and but to be frank, I was actually surprised how long we were able to hold our ER together without a closure, because we had been seeing them in rural BC for quite a while. You know, Port Hardy, Kitimat has weekly closures, you know, pretty much. All you know, a lot of communities along Highway 16, in the interior, Clearwater, it goes on. And yeah, it's a really hard situation. It's not for lack of want or trying or investment. When people say, well, you need to pay people more, you need to give them this and give them that, what I don't think people realize is that we've invested so much on the health human resource crisis we're facing. Like, I mean, I know this is policy wonkish, but we have a 70-point health human resources strategy to actually address this, this big challenge that's felt in urban BC as well. But I think it's particularly felt in rural BC, because if you're down one or two doctors or one or two nurses in some communities, that can be like half your workforce, or that's a matter of staying open or not. Whereas one or two in the lower mainland isn't felt as, it's not as impactful. But we are, we have done so much. If any nerdy, geeky person would love to go dive into that health human resources strategy, we're definitely paying people more. We've changed the funding model for physicians, which has actually brought thousands of physicians back into the workforce. We're streamlining the process for international healthcare workers to get working here quicker, more easily. You know, not that we're known as the government of cutting the red tape, but we've actually cut a lot of red tape as far as trying to get those qualified people to be able to offer services here in BC. We're going to open up the first medical school in Western Canada's history for the last 50 years in Western Canada. And we've opened up pre-med, med, we've opened up 602 new nursing spaces, allied healthcare workers, more nurse, we create a laddering program. If you're a healthcare worker, you want to be an LPN, we're making it easier, more affordable, LPN to RN, etc. And one thing I'm really actually proud of that I was able to help get done before my term was up as the Parle Sec for Rural Health was expanding midwifery training seats, and also, you know, setting designated certain seats for Indigenous midwives, because we know that that's a growing need in a lot of the rural, remote, and Indigenous communities. We've seen, for example, in Bella Bella, one of the first in community births in decades, just recently. And you know, as going back to being the critic, and now as the parliamentary secretary, I understand now, having represented so many Indigenous communities, that when you're Haida, you want to have your baby in Haida territory. It's the same that I learned in the Central Coast. You know, Newhawk children are often born in Williams Lake or Vancouver, and it's really important to a lot of Indigenous communities that their babies be born on their territory. And so I think, you know, doing whatever we can to facilitate that, makes sense. I'm glad that we're making headway on that. I mean, of course, we have a long way to go. We're just really getting started. But, you know, birthing or, you know, delivering babies in home communities, I think it's one of those things that we medicalized a little bit too severely, and we just out of preservation and out of the abundance of caution and wanting to be safe, we have centralized a lot of that. And that makes sense for a lot of things in healthcare. For example, if you need a brain surgery, you're not going to get that in Prince Rupert, and nor does that make any sense. But, you know, having babies in rural BC, I think we need to bring that back, and we need to set up systems so that that's a safe thing for people to do.
In all communities. One thing you mentioned there that I just want to touch upon, you began your provincial political career in opposition and you're ending it in government. What's kind of the difference? Because I know a lot of the time people ask about this. You know, what's kind of changes? What changed for you? What changed for the party when you guys went from critic and you know, being very critical about a former government on a lot of these issues, and as you mentioned, including healthcare, rural healthcare, to now being in power and having to answer to some of these issues that we're finding with healthcare and other things?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, opposition to government, totally different things. 2013, being elected into an opposition government, brand new for me, rookie MLA. It was like learning from a fire hose. And then come 2017, it felt very similar because it was a totally different situation, so much more to learn. But there's this cliche saying in politics that the worst day in government is still better than the best day in opposition. And I believe that to be true, because it's amazing to be able to have your hands on the levers and be able to push and pull them and make life better for other people. And that's why we're there. That's why we want to go and represent our communities in Victoria. And I just think that's such a privilege, an honor to be able to be in that position. And I find it quite satisfying that we've been able to do so much since being in government. And I'm proud of the work that we've accomplished.
One of the biggest pieces of legislation that you're leaving behind is the HIDTA title. This just happened. There's been a lot of praise, especially from Indigenous councils and government, about this, that it's the first in the country, first in Canada. It could be a blueprint for others down the road. But there's also been some criticism, obviously, from your political opponents. How do you feel about this? How did it come to be? And where does it go from here now that you're on your way out of politics?
Yes. So the HIDTA Title Recognition Act, or it was actually an amendment to the act, was passed on the Wednesday, so that would be almost 3 weeks ago. It was passed on a Wednesday, and then I announced that I was not re-offering for the 2024 election on the following Thursday. And quite frankly, I feel like I couldn't have gone out. I was very nostalgic and sentimental and emotional. It was very bittersweet for me to announce I'm not re-offering, but you know, announcing that the day after we passed that legislation, it was like such a sense of accomplishment. I couldn't ask for a better time. I feel good about leaving. You know, I'd rather be leaving on a high note than being voted out. And I feel really good about it. I think, you know, a lot of the fear is actually ironic, the fear of the uncertainty, as people express. But in fact, the HIDTA Title Recognition Act provides the certainty that people are actually talking about, that they're angsting about. And what I mean by that is, for example, the HIDTA title is probably the most clear-cut and easiest title case we have in Canada. They're an isolate. There's no overlap with other nations. There's no competition as far as whose territory is what. You know, there's so much evidence, archaeological, anthropological, oral history, that, you know, the Haida were the first people on Haida Gwaii. That is their territory. I don't think anyone could really dispute that. And so therefore, because Aboriginal title is still so uncertain in British Columbia, having that recognized actually provides people the certainty that might have come if it was established through litigation. So what I'm saying is this is the first time where we've recognized title through negotiation versus being forced to accept that title exists through litigation in the court systems. And what we've learned is that when we leave it to the court systems, they are basically answering a yes or no question. Yes, you have title. No, you don't have title. And then how you work all that out has been left to other levels of government, in the province in this case. So by doing it this way, all the unknown questions are getting answered and being sorted out. And so people who are afraid actually have more certainty. So for those that are afraid that their land might have to be given up, or that they have to, their houses will be expropriated, that is uncertain everywhere. It is very clear that that cannot and will not happen on Haida Gwaii. And that is something that we negotiated as the province with the Council of the Haida Nation. And so those people have more certainty. It's other people everywhere else in BC where title has not been established that are actually more vulnerable. So I think it's amazing. It's long overdue. When the opposition, when the critic, Michael Lee, was saying we need more time, I find it so, consultation wasn't enough. I find that so ironic that generations of Haida people have, waited or been told there needs to be more time. And, and we know through decades of just colonial history that people haven't been properly consulted. So it's so interesting to hear that from the other side, from the non-Indigenous side. But I'm proud of that work. Everyone knows it's true. We should acknowledge that, and we should forge forward on living harmoniously. Jason Alsep or Gogwis, the president of the Council of Haida Nation, people should go back and listen to his words, his speech that he made in the BC legislature. It was not one of adversity. It was not one of divide and conquer. It was not one of, wiping out the non-Indigenous people from their territories. It was actually the complete opposite. It talked about living harmoniously together, working together, respecting non-Indigenous people who have been integrated into the community, and vice versa. So that's a great job. I'm sorry people are uneasy about it, but it's new, and change is hard. Even when it's positive, it's hard to adjust.
Speaking of change, you're headed for some big changes in your life. And I guess this is a kind of a two-part question. We're seeing a pretty divisive time in politics, probably the most we've seen in a very, very long time, if ever. And both in federal and provincial politics especially. Where do you see this kind of going? The political, I guess, decorum even? How you deal and work with other parties? And just kind of the atmosphere? And also for yourself, you're taking on a big change here. You got two little kids. What comes next for you?
Well, it's funny because people keep asking me, what are you going to do? And when I tell them, it's like people don't actually believe me. But so first of all, very difficult decision to leave. I love this work. I feel like in 11 years of serving, the last two have been my best as far as being able to deliver for my communities. And so it's a conflicting situation where you're like, well, I'm doing well right now. This is my most productive years. Why would I end now? I'm on a roll. However, I don't see myself not being in service anymore. It's just, I'm looking for a different way of being in service that allows me to just be home a little bit more often. Everyone reminds me that time flies and they grow up so fast. And so I don't want to miss it. And so hence it was more of a last minute decision to not reoffer right now. Saying that, though, I've been encouraging a prominent leader and a friend for quite some time, encouraging her to get involved in provincial level politics, and we've been, you know, spending time talking about it for the last year, and she's been very involved with the NDP party. And so I literally called her on the Wednesday, and I said, how ready are you? You ready? And she's like, oh, I'm ready, Jen. And I said, okay, well, I'm announcing tomorrow that I won't be reoffering, and I really think that you should put your name forward. And she did. And so I'm endorsing Tamara Davidson, who is a vetted candidate by the party. So she's, you know, passed all scrutiny. And she announced just a week ago now. It's all a blur for me, but as an approved candidate, so where she can openly talk about it and reach out to members, and she's been working really hard. And she's a prominent Haida woman who actually was on the negotiating team for the Council of Haida Nation for Bill 25. So, yeah, I've seen her at the negotiating table, but I've also seen her in all kinds of other scenarios, and she's worked with the federal government for decades, and she knows the inner workings of the provincial and the federal government. She's already got that well established. She's not starting where I did in 2013, which was like learning by fire hose. So she's, you know, should she be selected, should she be nominated, you know, she'll be stepping into at a much higher level than I was over a decade ago. But I think she'll be a phenomenal MLA. And I think, you know, those people who talk about the fear of Bill 25, I don't think they need to be afraid. I mean, I wouldn't encourage Tamara if I didn't think she could represent all the diverse constituents that make up the North Coast. Yeah. I mean, you have a lot of interesting characters from all sorts of backgrounds. Prince Rupert, I think, special in the sense that we have, you know, over 100 South Asian families. We have a large Vietnamese community. Of course, nearly half the town is First Nations. We're here on Tsimshian territory, but we're also a gathering place for Nisga and Taltan and a lot of the Wet'suwet'en nations up the Skeena, but also down the coast. Yeah. You know, genetics fitness, which is right next door to my office in Prince Rupert. Yvonne is Helsik. She's from Bella Bella. So, I love that about Rupert. Chinese community, Japanese community, like it just goes on. It's diverse, and I completely trust that Tamara will be a phenomenal representative of, you know, not just Indigenous people, but everybody that lives here.
Just last thing for you, Jen, as I mentioned earlier, you know, you're leaving at an interesting time in the political atmosphere that's, you know, been created over the last number of years. How do you feel where things are headed and kind of what comes next for the party?
It is definitely interesting times politically. And I have to say that it was very uncomfortable for me for the last few weeks of the legislative session. Mind you, they call that the silly session or the silly season when all sorts of opposition MLAs are doing, you know, provocative actions or saying provocative things because they want to get attention put on them and get the media. But it was very disturbing for me. I mean, I couldn't believe that in 2024, and after 10 years or 11 years of being in service, that we actually were talking about a women's right to choose, abortion, trans, the whole transphobia issue being just resurrected in vitriolic anti-soji. Yeah, it was hard, I have to tell you, and it's a bit jarring. It's not something I expected. This last session, I actually had a little bit of fear going to work, going into the legislature, and I feel like people somehow, maybe it's provoked by COVID, where we've seen some extreme behavior. And I'm grateful for the security at the Legislative Assembly, But even the fact that when I went to work on the first day of this fall session, there was so much security, even that in itself was anxiety provoking for me. Two things can be true in the same breath. I was really happy that they were there because I have felt threatened in other situations, and that's certainly an erosion of democracy and, you know, the right to assembly and just civil disobedience. It's been a lot for me. I don't know if it's just I'm getting older and I've been doing it 11 years, but I didn't feel that way in the beginning. In fact, I always felt safe.
Well, Jen, we'll leave it there for now, but thanks so much for giving us your time and good luck on the road ahead.
Thank you so much, Dan. It's been fun.
You've been listening to CICK News. If you have any hot tips or news stories you think we should cover, contact us at CICKnews@smithersradio.com or follow us on Facebook at CICK News. CICK News is made possible by the Government of Canada and the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the only organization mandated to financially supporting campus and community radio stations across Canada. You can also catch our fresh shows each week at theskeena.com or subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. Thanks to our producer Pam Hassan and all of our roving reporters, I'm Dan Messick. Thanks for listening.